The lesson is from Luke chapter 7, which starts off with this phrase, after he had finished all his sayings. What are these sayings that Jesus had spoken in the presence of the people? Well, he had just delivered really a masterful sermon in chapter 6. And I would like for us to consider some of those things that he had said, especially in the latter half of his sermon in chapter 6, because this scene in chapter 7 is set up almost as a living illustration of some of those things that he had spoken in his sermon. For instance, Jesus spoke about love. Now, the Pharisaic teaching that the people had heard would have been that you should love, but with limits. Limits both in what you should have to give, and limits in terms of who you should have to give it to. You should love only those who are like you. Love those who love you back. Love those who would benefit you. But Jesus talked more about a divine love and gave a different standard. He said in Luke 6, verse 31, summarizing his teaching on love, and as you wish that others would do to you, do so to them. That is the standard. What is it that the person needs? That is more important than what you would feel inclined to give or what they may have done to you in the past. Jesus also said that we should love even those who have abused us, even those who seek to impoverish us. We still need to seek the welfare of those people. Our example for this is God Himself. God Himself, who is kind to the ungrateful and to the unrighteous, God still sends the sun and the rain upon those people and gives them good things according to their need. We see that in verses 35 and 36. And Jesus calls us in verse 36 to be merciful, even as your Father is merciful. God, when He is merciful, does not simply consider what you deserve, whether you are worthy of His blessings. Rather, He gives because He Himself is love, and He Himself is kind. Jesus spoke about the hearts of people, that our fruits depend, our outward fruits, the things that our mouth speaks, our teachings even will depend on what kind of heart we have. And He spoke about good hearts bringing forth good treasures, bringing forth good treasures out of a good heart, and likewise for evil hearts. Jesus spoke about the need to obey Him, that if we are going to call Him Lord, in verse 46, He says, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and not do what I tell you? If we are to recognize Jesus as Lord, that will require doing what Jesus says that we should do. Jesus, in the next verse, says that everyone who comes to me and hears my words and does them, I will show you what he is like. He is making an invitation there to really everyone, opening up the door to all the world who is willing to come to listen and to do. That person will be acceptable to him. And that person will set down a good foundation for their life, a foundation that is based on Jesus' words, on God's mercy. And that is a good foundation that will withstand the storm of judgment in the future. So these are some of the things that Jesus spoke about. And as we go through and read about this story of the centurion and Jesus, I want you to consider with me where some of these things are illustrated, where some of those teachings are illustrated in this story. The centurion is going to be, in fact, a positive example. Chapter 7 then, verse 2. A centurion had a servant who was sick and at the point of death, who was highly valued by him. When the centurion heard about Jesus, he sent to him elders of the Jews, asking him to come and heal his servant. Now, what is a centurion? For those of you who may not be familiar with the term, the centurion was, first of all, a Roman. A Roman, what did the Jews think about Romans? Well, they were the oppressive nation, the oppressive empire that had come and taken over their land. And how did they do that? Through the military. So a centurion was a commander within the Roman military, and therefore he would have been probably the most hated of the Romans. He would have been the very enemy that the Jews would have most been tempted to hate. So I say that when Jesus says in verse 47 of chapter 6 that everyone who comes to me, he really means everyone. He is accepting no one. Anyone who is willing to come to Jesus, anyone who is willing to humble himself, to listen and to do, is welcome to him. Now, of course, as you read this, the Jews are, in fact, have an admiration for this particular centurion. That must have taken a lot to be able to get to that point where the Jews would actually, for this particular Roman, have some admiration. But why is it? Let me ask that. Why is it that they have a love for him? Is it because they themselves are loving? They themselves are kind and gracious, even to the ungrateful and the unworthy? No, it is because this man, according to verse 5, loves the nation and has in fact benefited them practically by building them a synagogue. So the Jews have benefited from this particular Roman. They can anticipate future benefits from this particular Roman, and therefore they love him. Therefore they want to do good for him. So these Jews are self-interested, even in their admiration of this man. They care nothing for him, but rather what he can do for them. Now, a centurion is, by definition, a man of authority, a man who understands what it is to be in control of others, to have servants. This man has not just one servant, but he has surely many servants and many soldiers under his control. And as he will later say, when I say to somebody, do it, they go and they do it. He understands what it is to be called Lord. That is a great illustration of chapter 6, verse 46. When we call Jesus Lord, we must consider him our commander. When he says go, we go. When he says do, we do. Now, even as he is a man of authority, he is a man who knows what it is to love those that are under his authority. His servant is sick. His servant is sick. Now, verse 2 says that this servant who is at the point of death is very dear to him, or highly valued by him. Now, as far as I know, this is the only time that an individual comes to Jesus on behalf of someone other than a family member seeking Jesus' assistance. So, this centurion's love that requesting Jesus to help his servant, this is a familial type of love. And that is a wonderful example that if we have any type of authority, we should love those who are under our charge. That is a good example of godly exercise of authority. You know, God, when he loves, it is surprising also because he is one who has all power and has all control. And you would think that such a one has no responsibility to care much about those who are so far below him. And yet, God, much more than even the centurion, cares about the weaknesses of those in his charge. The servant is sick. He is at the point of death. There is no one else who can help him. Only the one who has the power over life or death. Physicians cannot help him. Not even the centurion with all of his worldly authority is able to help him. Matthew chapter 8, verse 6, that records this story, says that he is bedridden, unable to move, suffering terribly. Now you might think the centurion would just look at his servant and think to himself, I can find another. That is not his thought. He is compassionate about this. He is actively seeking solutions such that when he hears that Jesus is about, he sends to Jesus for assistance. Do you know what the centurion is doing? He is treating his servant as himself. He is treating someone who he may very well have thought is much lower than I, who is not as important as I, who cannot do that much for me, is easily replaceable, and yet he saw that man and loved him as himself and spared no effort to seek assistance for him. Well, what does he do exactly? Well, he sends elders of the Jews to speak on his behalf. No one's going to want to shake my hand afterwards. I'll try and use hand sanitizer, don't worry. elders of the Jews come on the behalf of this man in verses 4 and 5. Why does he send elders of the Jews? Well, he explains in verse 7, in fact, a little later on. He says, I did not presume to come to you. I did not presume to come to you. So, the humility of this man, his feeling is of unworthiness, is such that he sends other people. Perhaps he thinks to himself, these are Jesus' own people. These are some of the covenant people. Maybe he even realizes that Jesus was sent specifically to Israel, as in Matthew 15, verse 24. In any event, he sends respected Jews. And he asks them to come and heal the servant. And what is amazing about this man's faith is that he believes in Jesus' power to heal. There is no record of him ever seeing Jesus heal a man. How is it that he has gained such faith? This is an important detail for our faith today, who we have not seen Jesus ever heal a man either with our own eyes. And yet verse 3 says that he heard about Jesus and had such faith that he would send for Jesus to come and heal. He had faith in Jesus' power to heal based on the reports, the faithful eyewitness reports that he had heard of Jesus' power. The same is available to us today. This account is, in fact, hearing about Jesus' great power from faithful witnesses. Well, they plead with Jesus earnestly. They have very urgent language, in fact. Verse 4, they came to Jesus. They pleaded with him. They pleaded with him how? They pleaded with him earnestly. Why is it that they are so serious, that they want Jesus so much to come and heal this centurion's servant? Surely it's because they care about this servant, right? No. This is no love or compassion for the servant. They don't even consider it really a service to him. They consider a servant for the centurion. They talk about he is worthy. They say, do this for him. They're not even worried, in fact, about friendship with the centurion. Rather, they receive favors for the centurion, and surely they hope for more. Now, on what basis do they say that Jesus should heal this centurion's servant? It is because the centurion, according to them, is worthy. The centurion is worthy. Now, that will contrast very sharply with the man's own assessment of himself, who will say in verse 6, I am not worthy to have you come under my roof. They say he is worthy. The man says, I am not worthy. Why is it? Well, it's because they surely have two different perspectives on how one becomes worthy. They believe that God's favors are bestowed on the basis of worth, not based on God's mercy. Is that what Jesus taught? That when Jesus was speaking about God's mercy in chapter 6, verses 35 and 36, said that God is merciful because he is merciful, not because people are worthy of it. He is kind, God says, to the ungrateful and the evil. That is how the Most High operates. So when favors are bestowed, it is not on the basis of worth, but rather on the basis of God's mercy. Now, why do they say he is worthy? They say because he loves the nation. For them, the nation of Israel was the key to getting into God's favor. Descendancy from Abraham was a sure way to have God's favor. And if you were not a member of the nation, well, the next best thing would be to love the nation. They believe that salvation is through Israel. Not that the salvation of Israel is through God's Christ. They believe that he is worthy also because he has built a synagogue. They are focusing clearly on an external act that the man did. They never consider the heart. They never consider the evil acts that might make one worthy. We make that same mistake, don't we? When we are judging others' righteousness or judging our own righteousness, it is far too easy to think about the things that are visible to everybody and to focus on the good visible things that we have done And in fact, to have a selective memory and to not put under consideration the evil things that we have done. What man is there who, when writing his autobiography, devotes a page to every sin that he has ever committed? Whether in word, thought, or deed. Would you like to read somebody else's autobiography? It would be a very long read, wouldn't it? What would your autobiography look like? Would you like to read your own autobiography if it included every misdeed you ever did? Would you like it read before God and all assembled humanity in the day of judgment? It is far too easy just to have a selective memory and just remember the things that we think make us worthy and to forget about the things that make us unworthy. This was the Jewish concept, the Pharisaic false teaching. Paul knocks that down in Romans chapters 1, 2, and 3. He teaches that salvation cannot be by the good things that we have done, for the things that we have done, in fact, leave us worthy of death. We are violators of the law. The law will not be able to be what saves us. Our ancestry will not save us. What then is the basis of entrance into the kingdom? Look at Matthew chapter 8. Matthew chapter 8, this is in fact the parallel account. The parallel account of the centurion and his servant. But it has a teaching of Jesus, a word spoken that is not recorded for us in Luke chapter 7. Matthew chapter 8, verse 10 and following. When Jesus heard this, he marveled and said to those who followed him, "Truly I say to you, with no one in Israel have I found such faith. I tell you, many will come from east and west and recline at table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, while the sons of the kingdom will be thrown into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." The sons of the kingdom will be those descended from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the people to whom it should have gone, and yet they rejected it because they did not have the faith of Abraham. Jesus is concerned much more about faith than he is about descendancy. So Jesus looks at the heart, and what he desires is a heart of faith. And he knows that any worth that you might have is going to be because God is merciful. Go back now to Luke chapter 7. And we will see Jesus' response. Jesus, in fact, goes with the Jews that have been sent. Verse 6, Jesus went with them. Now Jesus is compassionate to the needs of this man. For again, he might not have necessarily been obligated to. The centurion finds out that Jesus is on the way. When the centurion finds that out, in verse 6, he sends friends. Now, by now, they are very close to the house. The centurion sends friends, surely with clear instructions of how to treat Jesus. And when the friends arrive, they call Jesus Lord. Lord. Now that itself is a demonstration of faith. To instruct his friends to call Jesus Lord. Now, it may be translated sir, I don't know. Sometimes when it's Lord, it's a simple sir of courtesy. Even if it were a sir of courtesy, that itself would be unexpected. Normally, when you see interactions between Roman soldiers, especially commanders, and lowly Jewish carpenters, you might expect coercement. Force. But here there is perfect courtesy at the very least, and I think that he is more likely recognizing Jesus' superior rank to his own. Again, think. We should call Jesus Lord, Lord, and we should do what he says, Luke 6:46. He is recognizing Jesus' worthiness. But at the same time, he recognizes and confesses his own unworthiness. He says, Lord, do not trouble yourself. What is he saying? He is saying, I'm not insisting that you prioritize my issue. I don't have the right to do that. I recognize that if you do this, it will not be because I can command you or you owe me in any way. If you do it, it will be on the basis of your kindness and of your condescension. Now he says, I am not worthy for you to have you come under my roof. I imagine that this centurion's roof was on the upper end of architecture in Jerusalem of his day. That his roof is probably the best kind of roof there was around there. And yet he says, Jesus, my roof is not good enough for you. My house is not good enough for you. This heart attitude of humility, lack of pretension, this is necessary when we are going to seek God's favor. This was made very clear to us by Brother Miguel in Psalm 51 today, where David says, it's not sacrifice and offering that are going to gain your favor. The sacrifices of God are what? A broken and a contrite spirit. These God will not despise. Do you have that broken and contrite heart? That is what God seeks. Now, another reason we mentioned before, a selective memory that makes us think we are more worthy than we are. But another reason why we sometimes have an overinflated estimate of our own worthiness. And that is because we are comparing ourselves to the wrong sin. We compare ourselves to the wicked and perverted generation that is around us. And as long as you are not totally given over to the same depravities, your light can't help but shine. And people will look at you and think you are righteous. They will even say it. But if you're comparing yourself to people of the world, you're comparing yourself to the wrong sin. You know, when I play basketball sometimes, I'm a middle school teacher, and I play with my middle school students. I dominate. I'm good. I get mad rebounds. I score a lot of points. I don't think I'm going to make it in the NBA anytime soon, though, do I? If I compare my basketball skills to those who are this tall, that makes me look good. You compare yourself to people of the world, you will think you are worthy. You will start to believe it. You must continually look at God's law so that you can see exactly what you are before Him and your deep need for His mercy. This man, even when he had so much authority, he will later on say that he is set under authority, verse 8. Even the authority that he had, he did not feel that he had earned it in any way, but it had been given to him, that God had placed him there. He says, I did not presume to come to you. To presume is to take for granted that your desire is correct and will preside. And he correctly observed that that attitude, that presumption when it comes to Jesus would be inappropriate. Jesus' will is what must preside, not my expectation. Here he says something that is great, demonstrates his faith. Say the word, but say the word, and let my servant be healed. Why does he do this? Not to boss Jesus around. Now, if anybody's bossing Jesus around, it is those Pharisees who say, you need to go and you need to do this. He's worthy. No, he simply says, say the word, so that Jesus would be least troubled. His itinerary would be least inconvenient. He is not putting Jesus to the test. He is certain that Jesus can do this. He is certain that Jesus can command illness in the same way that he is able to command his servants and expect that that will be accomplished. The only question in his head then is whether Jesus would grant it enough importance. And Jesus has answered that by coming to help the man. Now Jesus, when he hears this, says verse 9, he marvels. That is not a common response for Jesus. He marvels at the man's faith. And he uses it to encourage the crowd. The crowd, why is the crowd there? Why is the crowd following? Well, surely, they want to see if Jesus can manage the miracle. They want to see it going to the house to see if Jesus can heal the servant. This man, the centurion, believed that Jesus could do it just by saying the word. Jesus is calling this crowd to greater heights of faith. This crowd is made up of Jews, the people of Israel, the supposed people of God. And this foreigner, puts by his faith, puts them to shame. They go to the house. They find the servant well. Thus showing that even though the man's faith was bold, it was well placed when he put his faith in Jesus. They were not far from the house, remember. That detail is recorded for us, that those servants met Jesus when they were not far from the house. When they left, the servant was at the point of death, bedridden, unable to move, suffering terribly. And when they returned, it must have been only a matter of minutes later, that man was healed. That is evidence that it took place when Jesus said the word, that healing. This man, this centurion, is an example of Luke 6:45. The good person, out of the good treasure of his heart, produces good. This man had a good heart, and therefore his words reflected that. His actions reflected that. And it is great and encouraging to me that Jesus cared more about his heart than about his ancestry, this man who was a Gentile. This man is also an example of Luke 6:47-48. Luke 6:47-48. Everyone who comes to me and hears my words and does them, I will show you what he is like. He is like a man building a house who dug deep and laid the foundation on the rock. And when a flood arose, the steam broke against that house and could not shake it because it had been well built. This man put his faith in a solid foundation. And it was not his own worthiness. I can't imagine a more shaky foundation than our own righteousness. His faith was certainly not on his descendants of Abraham, descendancy from Abraham. Because he wasn't. He didn't have that option. No, he chose well his foundation. And that was Christ's compassion. He had a faith. And he had a faith that recognized Jesus as Lord. Lord in such a way that he knew that Jesus had the power to command him. In obedience, another. The question now for you is, where is your foundation? If you are one that resists coming to God because you believe you're good enough, examine your heart to see if that's really what you think it may be. That is the number one reason, I think, that people won't even bother to study the Bible with you. You come to them and you say, here, we have good news. We have good news. This is the cure. But if they don't believe they're sick, they don't want the cure. If they don't believe they're sick, then they won't receive it as good news. Maybe that's you. And you've been resistant to obeying the gospel simply because you don't fully recognize your need for it. Be as this centurion. And recognize your own unworthiness and your need for Jesus' help, your desperation for Jesus' help. Don't be like the Pharisees. They had a wrong foundation. Oh yes, and when the storm broke against it, their house would fall. We appreciate your attention as we went through this. And again, we renew that call. To those of you who may be in need of the salvation of Jesus, this would be a good time for you to make a confession of faith before everybody, to announce that you have repented of your sins, and we'll be happy to baptize you today for the forgiveness of your sins so that you can have Jesus as your Lord.